Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We turn now to look at events that unfolded over the weekend related to the school shooting in Michigan that took 4 lives and wounded 7 others. The parents of the alleged teenage shooter were charged with involuntary manslaughter Saturday, with Michigan prosecutor Karen McDonald calling the actions of the parents, Jennifer and James Crumbly, egregious.
I have shared previously, and I will reiterate today, that gun ownership is a right. And with that right comes great responsibility.
Charges against parents in school shootings are rare. We look at why and what potential impact parental criminal liability has in preventing shootings by minors. And for that, we're joined by John Woodrow Cox, an enterprise reporter for The Washington Post and also author of Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. John Woodrow Cox, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you remind us what the parents of the shooter have been charged with, what involuntary manslaughter means and means in Michigan?
So, it's really extraordinary, frankly, that they're being charged with such serious crimes. And it's because of the very high bar that those specific charges come with. Both parents are charged with 4 counts each of involuntary manslaughter, which would require the prosecutor to prove that they knew that this would happen, that this would be the result, or they had a reckless disregard. That is my understanding of what the prosecutor will have to prove before a jury. But what she alleged, the level of negligence that she alleged in that press conference was, I think, the worst that I have ever heard of when it comes to a school shooting. I anticipate that the defense will counter that argument and say that she was those allegations are not accurate. But based on what she said, I cannot think of a case of worse alleged negligence.
Yes, talk about that. What were some of the charges that the prosecutor outlined that struck you so much?
Well, just the level
or the acts as well. Sorry, not just charges, but the acts of the parents, the actions.
Right. Yes. What they knew in advance. I mean, so the first aspect of this is that they bought this firearm as a Christmas gift, quote Christmas gift, as his mother described it on social media for their son. He posted a photo with the 6-hour 9mm. He's calling it my new beauty. And said that he would answer questions of anybody who had any. Just before the shooting, a teacher saw that he was looking up, searching online. This was on the Monday before the shooting, searching online for ammunition, where to buy ammunition, and alerted the parents to this. And the mother, Jennifer Crumbly, texted him specifically, LOL, I'm not mad at you. You have to learn not to get caught. In the hours before the shooting, there was a parent-teacher meeting because they had found this note that the teenager had written that was, it was violent. He was using violent language and drawing violent images, and clearly fantasizing about a school shooting. There's this parent-teacher meeting, and they resisted, allegedly resisted the idea of him being taken out of school that day, and they did not search his backpack. You know, knowing that he had access to a firearm, they didn't think to, or they just didn't look in his bag to see if there was a gun there. And, you know, hours later, the shooting started. You know, now four kids are dead.
What also about the fact that the parents, the prosecution says that they went missing on Friday afternoon,
right,
potentially fleed, though defense attorneys say that there was some miscommunication around that and that that wasn't their intent.
Yeah, that is still sort of very much in dispute. What, why exactly they left? I mean, the way that certainly the prosecution and law enforcement has framed this is that this was they were in hiding. You know, that they were actively, you know, running away, trying not to be caught. And the evidence implies that, you know, that that's what was happening. I mean, they knew certainly who was looking for them, and they had known that for quite a long time before they were caught. And, you know, there's that part of the investigation is ongoing. The person who allegedly harbored them, you know, they were nowhere near their hometown, you know, the place where the shooting occurred. So,
yep. Well, we'll talk more with John Woodrow Cox right after the break. Stay with us. This is Forum.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about Michigan prosecutors' decision to bring involuntary manslaughter charges against the parents of the teenager accused of killing four classmates at his high school last week and wounding seven others. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What are your reactions to the Michigan prosecutors' decision to charge the parents of the 15-year-old? Are you a gun owner? What do you think of safe storage laws? What questions do you have about safe storage laws or parental liability in school shootings? 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. Get in touch on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at KQED Forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Do you agree with the Michigan prosecutor's decision? John Woodrow Cox, one of the things that you have done is an analysis of school shootings, sources for the weapons that are used, and so on. What does your research tell you about the potential effectiveness of the threat of parental liability in preventing gun violence? I mean, how much of it is related to parents' guns or parents' handling of those kinds of weapons around their children?
So, you know, we know, sort of broad strokes, we know that if children did not have access to firearms, more than half of the school shootings, well, more than half of the school shootings since Columbine would never have happened. So that is something, you know, when I often talk about this and I dive deep into it in my book, if that was the one change we made as related to guns overnight, it would have a dramatic effect simply if adult gun owners locked up their firearms, if they didn't let those firearms fall into the hands of children. We did a review back in 2018 where we were trying to figure out how often parents were charged with these crimes, and found that among 105 cases in which the source of the weapon was identified, these are juvenile shooters, 80% of the time the gun was taken from the child's home or those of friends or relatives. At that time, this was in 2018, just four adults had been convicted for failing to lock up the guns that were used. So, you know, we knew at that time it was incredibly rare. And part of that certainly was because of the lack of storage laws, these child access prevention laws, safe storage laws, those are the terms we use for those. And they're basically laws that, in broad strokes, they mandate that adults lock up their firearms, and if their firearms fall into the hands of a child and that child uses that gun to harm themselves or someone else, then the adult gun owner can be held criminally liable. We know that those laws are effective. The RAND Corporation has done an ongoing study of basically every bit of research available out there on gun policy, and consistently found that safe storage laws make the biggest difference. There is the most evidence to show that they prevent things like violent crime, that they reduce risk of accidental shootings, and that they reduce suicide. These do make a difference. At the same time, we know that prosecutors often don't use these laws, or the laws are too weak.
Right? Why is that? Of the weakness of the law or other reasons?
Often it's the weakness of the law. I know of anecdotally, I know of several cases in which the prosecutor decided not to use the law because it was only a misdemeanor. And they felt like, well, this is too serious. So let's say if Michigan did have this law and it was similar to what we see in other states, and it came with misdemeanor charges, it's highly unlikely that the prosecutor would have actually used that law in the state of Michigan, because she wants serious felony charges that will come with substantial prison time. That's what she was pursuing in this case. So a misdemeanor child access law would not have been effective, I think, in terms of what the prosecution wanted to pursue. Where we need more research, but where I theorize, having reported and researched this subject for many years, I think there is an element of education that occurs when a state passes one of these laws. And what that means is that, you know, most gun owners, in my experience, want to do the right thing. They don't, in fact, want their child to find their gun and shoot themselves or shoot their neighbor or their sister or brother or cousin. They don't want that to happen. But they are under the misguided belief that they can educate their kid out of making a bad choice with a gun. This is a commonly held belief among gun owners, partly because the NRA has pushed that idea that you can educate a child out of making bad choices with a gun. It is fundamentally untrue. It's proven to be untrue. But when this law comes along and suddenly you have a child access prevention law in your state, it's my suspicion that a great many gun owners just decide based on that suddenly, that liability, that they need to lock up their firearms. And that's where I think we see that effectiveness, because I don't think it's coming on the other end where, you know, people are being punished criminally over and over through these laws, because we know that's not that common, at least as it relates to school shooting.
Well, let me go to caller Adam in San Francisco. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hello, good job. I just want to comment that I'm so pleased that these parents are being charged. I think that they desperately need to make an example with this, because, you know, sensible gun laws are what is needed in order for the guns to go forward. Too many people are anxiously trying to end the Second Amendment, and these are the people that help create that kind of atmosphere. We need sensible gun laws. California laws seem to be working. It's hard to imagine people's mentality when they are capable of doing such things. I grew up with guns. I had guns in my house. I never had any kind of idea of any kind of this preposterousness that has happened since Columbine.
Adam, thanks. Curious, John, who is opposed to gun laws or parental liability laws related to children committing acts with guns? Because I remember from our conversation in April, where you were discussing, as you said earlier, sort of parents can sort of be misinformed about whether or not their kids will actually be curious enough to try out their gun, that they can just sort of educate them out of it. We also talked about how generally there is bipartisan agreement around trying to make sure that guns are stored safely and kept from children.
Right. You know, that is one unique thing about these sorts of laws, is they actually do nothing to, let's say, affect someone's constitutional right to go out and buy firearms, to own firearms. You know, as I write in my book, you know, you can still go buy 15 AR-15s if you want to. What these laws require is that you are responsible with the guns that you have, that you don't let those firearms fall into the hands of children. Where I think there is some discomfort and where there is some pushback on these specific laws is among gun owners who behave the same way with their guns, as they think it's perfectly fine for their child to have access to their firearms. In fact, I've heard the argument in some places that, well, it's actually necessary because what if there's a home invader? I want my teenager to be able to get the gun and shoot the home invader, which is near fantasy. I mean, that is so incredibly rare, that exact sort of specific scenario, when you compare it to how often that same child would get that gun and take their own life intentionally or by accident. I mean, it's, I don't know what the numbers are, but hundreds and hundreds of to one. It's, you know, far, far, far more likely that a firearm in the home is going to harm the child than the child is going to use the gun to, you know, take the life of a home invader. So that is where, though, you might see some discomfort. In 2018, I went to Kentucky to write about a school shooting there. A teenager, a 15-year-old, you know, the same age as the kid in Michigan, got his stepfather's gun. It was unlocked. He had access to lots of ammunition. He took it to school. He shot 16 people in less than 10 seconds. He killed two of them. And the prosecutor there seriously considered charging the parent. He ultimately decided he couldn't come up with a charge that he thought would stick. But in talking to gun owners in that community, what I kept hearing over and over is you would have a jury of people looking at this guy and saying, well, my gun at home isn't locked up. What if my kid or my grandkid takes that gun and uses it to shoot somebody else? Should I be charged too? So, you know, that's where I think there has to be, to make progress on this issue, there has to be a cultural shift. And it seems like those laws could actually start that conversation, right? Where somebody, at least for the first time in their life, thinks, well, maybe I shouldn't trust my kid with access to that firearm.
Well, there are a couple of comments coming in around the same idea of accessory to murder. Paul writes, it seems to me that accessory before the fact is the more appropriate charge for the parents, since they obtained the weapon, which, as I understand it, the child could not legally purchase. The crime they aided in is murder, not manslaughter. Edward tweets, all gun owners should be charged with accessory to any crime committed by the gun, regardless if it was lost, loaned, or was stolen. Whoever buys the gun is responsible for the gun and the crimes committed with it. What do you think about that? Is there any movement in that direction?
I don't think so. I mean, the bar is very, very high to charge anyone in a gun crime unrelated to the person who pulled the trigger. You know, maybe the one exception is when we talk about felony murder, and that's a case where, let's say, three people are robbing someone. One of those people who is committing the robbery has a gun, shoots someone and kills them, then often others involved in the robbery will also be charged with felony murder. But, you know, historically, it has been very, very difficult to charge someone with any kind of serious crime. You know, this is even in cases where you have gun traffickers who are selling guns to gang members who they then know are going to use those guns to murder people. I mean, where there is knowledge ahead of time, which is maybe even a step further than you would see with the parent being negligent with the gun. These are people who are selling guns to people who they then know are going to use them to commit murders. So, and not even in those cases do you see accessory oftentimes. So this will be a fascinating case study. And I think a lot of other prosecutors will look at this case and say, you know, do these charges stick in a state that is, you know, purple, maybe leans a little bit red. You know, it's certainly not a liberal state, quote unquote. So whether these charges stick, I think will send a message to lots of other prosecutors and maybe to other parents to say that, oh, this is the potential. This is the potential outcome if someone is negligent with their firearm.
John Woodrow Cox is enterprise reporter for The Washington Post, author of Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. And you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Let me go to Joel in Pacifica next. Hi, Joel.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning to you. Go right ahead.
I have a simple question. Since the Michigan prosecutor is looking to find the parents criminally liable for this. What effect will that have on the prosecution of the child? The child's certainly looking more sympathetic to me as I learn what the parent's role in all of this was. I wonder what kind of legal ramifications that has for the kid.
Hmm. John Woodrow Cox, any ideas?
I think that'll be fairly limited. I mean, part of the defense's argument will be that they'll say likely, the defense's argument on behalf of the child, they'll, I'm sure, put blame on the parents, and they'll put blame on the school, and because that's the job of a defense attorney, right? Is to spread the blame. I don't believe there is any dispute, however, about who committed this act. You know, I don't think anyone's disputing that. You know, they know who the shooter is. He took four lives. You know, he ended four lives and gravely wounded a number of other people. So while that will be an argument, this case may not even get to that point. You know, it may not even get to a jury. But I'm sure the defense will use that argument. But they're still dealing with a set of facts that are beyond dispute. We know who pulled the trigger, and so that's going to be a hard thing to get over, I think.
Amy writes, the whole story is so disturbing and tragic. I'm still confused as to why the school officials did not do more. They saw the notes he'd written, which were violent and bloody, and he actually asked for help in one note. I cannot believe the principal, counselors, and teachers allowed him to go back to the classroom, and no one searched his backpack. Unbelievable. John Woodrow Cox, we did hear Prosecutor Karen McDonald tell CNN this morning that school officials in Michigan had legal grounds to search the teenager's backpack, but mm-hmm. failed to do so. I'm curious about prosecutors potentially turning their attention to the culpability of the school and what effect you think that might have as well in terms of prevention.
Yeah, you know, that is a very good question. It is a very good question. And I think one that, there's going to require a lot more investigation. I think, you know, just speaking historically, it would be exceedingly rare for a criminal case to be brought against a teacher or an administrator. In this case, I can't even think of one that would be virtually unheard of. But what is not unheard of is civil litigation. That feels likely in this case. I mean, we've seen it in cases where there was far less alleged negligence on behalf of a school, and the school gets sued, and you know is held liable to some degree. So you know, it is a bit of a mystery. You know, why a kid who was clearly having violent thoughts and had now the school did not, I guess, know that he had access to a firearm. His parents did know. So who was more to blame about not searching that backpack is certainly going to be a point of debate, but there will be a lot of scrutiny applied to the school, why he was allowed to go back to class, why maybe law enforcement wasn't immediately called when they found threats, him writing threats, drawing threats. I think in other school districts, probably law enforcement would have been called in right at that moment. So a lot of questions yet to be answered.
Well, this listener writes, the core issue is how do teenagers get to be this way? How does someone like the shooter get to the point where they snap and plot and plan and pick up a gun and start shooting people either at a school or any public place? This is what we need to learn about and discuss, not we need real gun control. John Woodrow Cox, when I talked to you earlier this year, we talked about mental health, but we talked about mental health related to the impact on the survivors. On the children, on the students who survive, on a community. Can you just give us a sense of what you must be thinking this community and the survivors of this shooting are going through and what they face coming ahead since you researched it so deeply?
Yeah, I mean, the ripple of these things is so gigantic. You know, we think about it in terms of the four who died, right? They're the ones who are in the headlines. And then maybe we think about it in terms of the seven others who were shot. That is a fraction of the pool of trauma that something like this will cause. It's all their families and all their friends and their cousins. It's all the kids who were hiding in classrooms thinking that they would also die. It's the teachers and administrators who thought the same, plus all their families. It's the first responders and their families. It's the reporters. It's the journalists who are on the ground there doing these interviews. I mean, the pool of people who will live with this for years is in the thousands. potentially the tens of thousands. That's what we never really come to grips with when it comes to these acts of gun violence, is the ripple. It's gigantic. It is not 4 or 11. It is thousands. And, you know, I feel for these people because I've reported a decade later on people who are still struggling with profound trauma after events like this one. So everybody needs to understand that the journey of grief will last years. It won't be weeks. It won't be months. It will be years.
And in the meantime, I think it was a Washington Post database that has found that in 2021, there have been more school shootings, 34, than in any year since 1999. John Woodrow Cox, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to Susan Britton and Ariana Prale for producing today's segment, and our listeners for their participation. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.